Parsha of Chayesara begins, it becomes the discussion of the burial of Sarah, but it starts with the description of Sarah herself. As we know, to see the pasuk, Vayuchai Sarah, Meyashana, Vesrim Shana, Vesheva Shanim, Shnei Chayesara. So it gives us her years, 100 years, 20 years, 7 years, or as Unklus puts it helpfully, 127 years, the years of the life of Sarah. And as always, we try and make sure that we are not glossing over anything or missing any of the signals in the pasuk. And a very simple question that relates to this opening pasuk is the final phrase, Shnei Chayei Sarah. After all, the pasuk could not have been more explicit in presenting her years, 127 years. That's done. Meyashana, Esrim Shana, Vesheva Shanim. What then does it add with this concluding phrase, Shnei Chayei Sarah? And interestingly, Rashi already addresses this point with a short phrase of explanation, comment of explanation. Kulon Shavim Latova. They were all equally good, all equal for the good. And as we can appreciate, Rashi comes to explain, and rapidly himself needs explanation. As if to say, what is the verse adding by saying they were all equally good? Especially in light of Rashi's earlier comment, which is a famous comment, dealing with 100 years, and the 20 years, and the 7 years, as Rashi says, 100 was like 20 for sin. In the eyes of heaven, a person is not indicted for sin till the age of 20, so 100 is like 20 without sin. And then 20 is like 7, liyofi, for beauty, whatever that means. Which means, according to Rashi, the numbers are already speaking. The tally in the beginning of the pasuk is already telling us effectively, kulam shavim latova, that they were all equally good in every respect. What then is needed to be added in the final phrase of the pasuk? Kulam shavim latova. And this is something that Mefarshi Rashi, as we can appreciate, deal with at length. What is interesting is, according to the Ramban, these words, kulam shavim latova, not only are they extra vis-a-vis the 100 and the 20 and the 7 and all of those equations that we mentioned, as far as the Ramban is concerned, and we need to watch carefully what he's saying, it's the final phrase that's really the basis of the equations made in the beginning of the pasuk. In other words, the Ramban maintains that the very fact that the pasuk alone broke it down into 100, and then 20, and then 7, that's not enough to start making equations. And says Ramban, I'll prove it to you. Because there are cases later, two actual cases later in our very own Parsha, where we have a similar breakdown of this year's and this year's and this year's. Shall we say that the intent there of the pasuk is also to equate them like this for something, like this for something? What are the two examples? Well, the first is Avram, which is interesting because the pasuk says something similar about Avram. And as far as Ramban is concerned, there's no you already cannot make these similar Sarah-like equations. That's in Perek Kafhei, Pasuk Zion. Let's see the Pasuk and try and see Ramban's point. Says Pasuk Zion of Perek Kafhei, Ve'ele yimei shnei chayei Avraham asher chai. These are Avram's years. Ma'as shana, v'shivim shana. A similar breakdown, 175. Says Ramban, are you going to say the same thing that you said with Sarah? 100 like 70 for this, 70 like 5 for something else? Clearly not. But what's interesting is, Rashi actually clearly does. Because commenting again on these words, Ma'at Shana, Rashi gets going in true, we could say, in true Sarah form. Ben Meah Kevin Shivim, Uben Shivim Kevin Hey, below Chet. So 100 was like 70, and 70 was like 5. without sin. So what the Ramban says, asks almost rhetorically, shall you do something similar in that pasuk? Rashi already has. Interestingly, Rashi's treatment of Avram's years is not exactly the same as his treatment of Sarah's years. That's true. In other words, if we note carefully, when it comes to Sarah, there were two separate equations. You had 100 was like 20 for one thing, for sin. 20 was like 7 for something else, for beauty. For Avram, you can't really break it down into two. You can't say 100 was like 70 for what? And that's why for Rashi, it's actually a compound equation. 100 is like 70, and then 70 is like 5. What they call in the Hilchos Shabbos business, a kli shlishi. So you get from 100 to 70, 70 to 5, and the point is by the time you're finished, he was like 5 years old without chet. So Ramban has thrown down the challenge with Avram, but Rashi is still expounding in this way with Avram himself, just by virtue of the fact that the pasuk has broken up the years in this way. However, the matter comes to a head 10 psukim later, where we find a similar breakdown of years with no less, or should I say, no more, a personality than Yishmael. And what does Pasuk Yud Zayin of Perek Kafhei say? Ve'ele shenei chaye Yishmael. These are Yishmael's years, ma'at shana u'shloshim shana b'sheva shanim. 100 years and 30 years and 7 years. And if you look at Rashi there, you will see that he doesn't comment at all on this, because there's nothing to say, nothing positive anyway, nothing the Torah would want us to know in that way. So from Yishmael, it seems, proves the point. Rashi would need to explain how he can take this approach with the first two and not with the third, with Yishmael. But as far as Ramban is concerned, you see from the Yishmael case that the breakdown itself is not sufficient cause to make these equations. Rather, says Ramban, the reason why Chazal in the Medrash do so in the case of Sarah is because of the concluding phrase, Shenei Chaye Sarah. That's indicating that all of these years are equal. When the Torah tells me that they're equal, I can make the equations as Chazal do. So interestingly, whereas for Rashi, as we've seen, there are two separate messages. The equations are first, and Shnei Chaye Sarah seems to be another message, Kulam Shavim Latova. Well, for Ramban, Kulam Shavim Latova is itself what allows you to start equating 100 with 20 and 20 with 7. And Ramban says that that is only stated here and it only applies here in the case of Sarah. Interestingly, just to move from Rishonim to Acharonim, much closer to our time, Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has a different understanding of Shnei Chaye Sarah. There is a well-known tradition in Chazal, Rashi quotes it partially, in different versions of it, with regards to the circumstances that led to the death of Sarah, which were tragic. I mean, not that it's ever not tragic, but specifically because it was a result of the Akedah. Rashi states simply that she expired as a result of hearing about the Akedah. Rashi doesn't elaborate, but we know from the Medrash that actually it was the Satan who somehow got the word to her about the Akedah. He conspired to let her know, presumably knowing what the results would be, and this would lead to potentially a compounded tragedy that Avram may actually come to regret ever having done the Akedah, seeing that it led to the death of Sarah. That's the game that the Satan has here. But Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says, it's important to establish, because it sounds like, and if it's true, this would be a one-off. What is the Satan's job, or more correctly, what are his capabilities? His role, shall we say, more correctly, is that he would tempt a person to sin, or so on and so forth. He does, as far as we know, he doesn't have the capacity to kill people. He can't carry out such exercises, even for his own gains, before their time. He can make them do things that are so bad that then heaven decides to kill them, but he can't independently and unilaterally work in that way. His job is to tempt, not to terminate. And that's where Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky says that the reality is, and I saw actually just a couple of days ago, an earlier Rabbi Yaakov of Lissa, The great Nesivos HaMishpat in the Sefer Nachlas Yaakov says exactly the same thing. Yaakov, Yaakov. They were both mechab into the same idea that the Satan didn't kill her before her time. He can't do that. It's not possible. It's not within his purview of his capabilities. But rather, this was her time. All the Satan can do, and now that this is the Satan at his best, or at his worst, is to take something that's happening anyway and portray it. When a person expires, we don't know exactly what led to what. If he can portray it as if it was a result of the Akedah, that's already enough to send Avram potentially in a downward spiral. That's the goal of the Satan. So in other words, to be clear, it's not that the Satan can kill her before her time. It was her time. He can depict her death as being as a result of the Akedah. That's the most he can do. But that we should be under no misapprehension that he actually ended her life before her allotted years. To that end, the Pasuk concludes with the words, Shenei Chaye Sara. These were her years. None were detracted. All he can do is put a spin on it, but not to actually detract from those years. So these are some classic approaches to the final phrase, and again, always important not to let things go in a casual basis, Shnei Chaye Sara, and to move on, to stop and examine and analyze each phrase for what it's contributing. In the main, moving on a little bit, the beginning of Parshas Chaye Sara is about the acquisition of Ma'aras HaMachpelah, or what would become Sedei HaMachpelah. After all, Ephron very conveniently says and changes Avram's description. Avram says, I'd like to buy the cave which is the side of your field. And Ephron starts talking about the cave which is in the middle of his field, as if saying to Avram, if you take the cave, what am I going to do with the field? So you're going to have to take the field also. And before you look around, what started as a cave has become a field. From Ephron's point of view, he has no qualms in doing this because he's officially giving everything to Avram anyway. But of course, he's just raising the asking price when the time comes. We do see that there is what certainly appears to be a tremendous arichus, protracted or lengthy and detailed description of every stage of the negotiations and acquisitions. Nothing is left unsaid, it seems. And Avram talks to these people, then he talks to Ephron, and then he hears back, and then he responds, and then he bows down, and then he says, please, my master, listen to me. And it goes on and on and on for until Pasuk Kaf, the first 20 Psukim, roughly. And that's something which should catch our attention. Something that could have been condensed into three or four psukim is really spread out in great detail. Not only is the acquisition of Ma'aras HaMachpelah described at great length and in great detail when it happens, but it seems that whenever the Torah can, it will mention it again. The whole thing. And that is something that exists whenever someone talks about being buried in Ma'aras HaMachpelah or is buried in Ma'aras HaMachpelah, you get the whole thing again. This begins in our own parsha towards the end because Avram is buried in Ma'aras HaMachpelah, and that's in Perek Kafhei, Pasuk Tes. And what does it say? So Avram passes away. Vayikberu oso. This is Pasuk Tes of Perek Kafhei. Vayikberu oso Yitzhak v'Ishmael banav. So Yitzhak and Ishmael, the sons, bury him. Where? El Ma'aras HaMachpelah. Okay, where is that? Well, everyone knows. It's the beginning of the Parsha. But the Pasuk goes through it. El Sedei Ephron ben Sochar Achiti, in the field of Ephron. Asher opnei Mamre, plains of Mamre. Next pasuk, Hasadeh Asher Kana Avraham Eitz Bnei Ches. This is the field that Avram brought. That's Ma'aras HaMachpelah. So if we'd forgotten from the beginning of the parsha, and how could we forget? It's 20 psukim, but the pasuk tells us again exactly what Ma'aras HaMachpelah is. This happens again. The end of Chumash Bereishis, in Perek Memtes, when Yaakov has finished giving the brachas to his children, in Perek Memtes, Pasuk Lamed, he then tells them, instructs them, as we know, do not leave me here. I want to go back to Marsa Machpela. And he says, in Pasuk Kavtes, Kivruosi Elabosai, bring me back to my father's Elamar Shebeste Efrenachiti. It's got to be in the field, in the cave of the field of Efrenachiti. Pasuk Lamed. This is the cave in the field of Machpelah. Asher apnei Mamre, Beretz Canaan. Asher kana Avraham es hasadem es Efron achiti lachuzas kover. Once again, the whole acquisition is reiterated. And what's even more striking is that in the very next perek, when the pasuk describes his burial, in perek Nun, pasuk Yud Gimel, it states by Yisuos Hoban of Arts of Canaan, they took him to Canaan, by Ruoso Bimrastea Machpelah, they bury him in Marsa Machpelah. Asher Kana Abraham Esasadelach Uzaskeva me is Efren Achiti Alpene Mamre. It just keeps on going. Every time we hear Marsa Machpelah, we get this a description of the background of the acquisition. And Kolze Omer Darsheni. Against all this, there is a fascinating contrast. And that is the way the Pasuk describes the burial of Yitzhak. And that is at the end of next week's parsha, which is in Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Kaf Tes. And let us see what happens there. Pardon me, not in the next week's parsha, in Parshas Vayishlach. Perek Lamed Hei, Pasuk Kaf Tes. Vayigva Yitzhak vayamas vayosef elamav. So he then is gathered to his people. He passes away. Zakenus vayamim, elderly, good years. Vayikberu oso Esav v'Yaakov banav. And Esav and Yaakov, his sons, bury him. And we, of course, are ready for the whole thing. That's it. Nothing else. There is no background to Marsa Machpelah. Not only is there no background to the acquisition of Marsa Machpelah, when it comes to Yitzhak, the Pasuk doesn't even tell us that he was buried there. It's an absolute silence. It just says they buried him. Where? We don't know. Isn't it relevant? I think so. Every other time we're told, and we're told the whole story. And here, there's no story, and there's no mention. So it's really, when we see the sweep of Chumash Bereishis, it's a very loud silence in the case of Yitzhak. What we may ask is behind all of this. So I believe that the basis of the entire matter is to understand exactly what Avram is looking to do in the beginning of our parsha. I think the way that we may simply describe it, and perhaps oversimply describe it, is Sarah, unfortunately, has passed away. Abram is looking for a place to bury her, and the place that he chooses is the one that he acquires. It's actually more than that. Abram is not looking just, quote-unquote, for a burial plot for Sarah. He is looking for a burial holding for the entire family. It's not just Sarah. It will start with Sarah, but he's looking for something much bigger, and that is what is called achuzas kever. He's not asking for a kever. He's asking for achuzas kever. Achuza is a holding. It's a whole estate. Achuza is an estate. And that's actually quite a big undertaking, because he's really approaching Bnei Ches and asking for something, actually, as the Ramban says, that one doesn't normally qualify for if he's not, let's say, a family from that region, or so, which he isn't, really. But he's looking, one could say, to apply for such status. And that's why when he approaches Bnei Ches, he refers to himself as Ger V'Toshav, which the simple understanding is, I may have come here as a Ger, but I am now a Toshav. And as a Toshav, Tenuli Achuzas Kever. And in fact, it's for this very reason that he doesn't approach Ephron directly. He first goes to a group of people who are called Bnei Ches. Now, who are Bnei Ches? They really are the, one could say, the regional council. They're the people who are in charge of that territory. And why does he need to speak to them before going to Ephraim? It's not just that he needs their help in soliciting Ephraim to sell him a specific property. He needs to go to the council of B'nai Ches because he's asking for something that only they can grant. Ephraim can't give that to him. Ephraim owns a property. He can sell him a property, but he can't sell him the right to use it and establish his family there through this property as Achuzas Kever. And therefore, as a prelude to approaching Ephraim, Avram first goes to B'nai Ches, and as he tells them, if we see the Psukim in Perek Kaf Gimel, Pasuk Dalet, he says, Ger v'toshav anochi imachem, I am a ger, but now a toshav, tunu li Achuzas Kever imachem. He wants a holding. It's a bigger acquisition. Now, B'nai Ches seem to respond very positively. And let's assume that's what's happening, because Avram says at that point, once they say yes, so he says, okay, now I'd like to speak to Ephraim. Now that I have permission for what I want to use it for, now I can actually approach the individual to sell him to purchase from him the particular property of Ma'ar Samachpela. And that really is what's responsible for many of these opening sukkim to understand the progression of what it is that Avram wants. And the truth is, not only is there a dual acquisition in a sense, the rights and the property, not only is that being described in real time, it's actually described in conclusion. Because if we look at the final psukim of Perek Kaf Gimel, which is Sheni, actually, we will see that the acquisition of Ma'ar Samachpela seems to be mentioned twice. The four final psukim of Perek Kaf Gimel are divided into two, and each set of two psukim is talking about, it just says the same thing. It just goes over it. Because Pasuk Yuzayin, Vayakam Sedei Ephron, Asher B'Machpela, Asher Lefnei Mamre. So the field then rose, as Pasuk Yud Ches says, La'avlam Lemikna, Neidei B'nei Ches. It was acquired to Avram. So that's the acquisition. Then Pasuk, or even Pasuk Kaf says again, Vayakam Asadeh V'Amara Shebo, La'Avram L'Chuzas Kover. And it came to him, Meis B'nei Ches, but that's the first description. Why is Avram's acquisition described twice over these four psukim? And this question is addressed by one of the great Baalei HaPshat among the Rishonim, Rabbeinu Yosef Bechor Shor. Rabbeinu Yosef Bechor Shor, who we've mentioned on a number of occasions, the Talmud of Rabbeinu Tam, very, very special Perush, and he says this explicitly, that the Pasuk describes Avram's acquisition twice because he was acquiring two things. As we said, and here we see it as it's capped in the Perek. He acquires a property, and he acquires the right to use it. And it's interesting that if we look in Pasuk Yud Ches, it says, L'Avraham L'Mikna L'Einei B'nei Ches. If we follow the psukim, it was an acquisition for Avram, L'Einei B'nei Ches, in view of B'nei Ches. The final Pasuk says, Me'eis B'nei Ches. It was from B'nei Ches. So was it from them, or was it in view of them? Says the Bechor Shor, the first psukim are dealing with the actual acquisition of the property. That's from Ephron to Avram. And that's why Pasuk Yud Zayin says, Vayakam Sedei Ephron, Asher B'Machpela. So that rose, and it came, La'Avram L'Mikna. It was acquired to Avram. So he acquired that from Ephron, Le'enei B'nei Ches. Everything is done in full vision of all the relevant parties, so that no one can object later on. They didn't know, they didn't see. So aspect one of the acquisition, the property itself, was from Ephron, Le'enei B'nei Ches. And how is that affected? With money. Arba Me'o Shekel Kesef. That's that. But then something else happened. Va'acharichein, says Pasuk Yutes, Kavar Abraham Es Sara Ishto. He buried Sarah. And through burying Sarah, meaning through acting on the very premise that he wished to acquire this for, he then cemented and sealed his rights to use this as an Achuzas Kever. That's Pasuk Kaf. Vayakam Asadeh, Vamarash, Shebo, Lavram, Achuzas Kever, Me'es B'nei Ches. That was from B'nei Ches. the property was acquired from Ephron, but the license to use it for the Achuzas Kever, that was acquired from Bnei Ches. So you see how the Psukim open up, and each one is describing a different element of what is happening here. That's it. But the truth is, there's more. There's more. And this idea becomes, the discussion is developed by Rabbi Mintzberg Zatzal in the Sefer Ben Melech. Because the truth is, the historic significance of what Avram is doing here goes beyond Maras HaMachpelah. This is nothing less than the very first acquisition of something in the land of Israel, which represents a concretization of Avram's holding in the entire land. Avram has been promised Eretz Yisrael. So far he's been walking through, and that has had a certain effect, and so on and so forth. But the very first acquisition of something in Eretz Yisrael is done in Achuzas Kever, and it's a very big statement, because Achuzas Kever means we're here to stay. And this, therefore, was the first step in the acquisition of Eretz Yisrael, and represents just another step in the totality of the land, really now coming into Avram's possession. And I think with this in mind, again, we see the details. We shouldn't get jaded by them. Every pasuk is in the first, when we come back to the concluding psukim of the acquisition, Yud Zayin to Kaf. So the first pasuk describes Maras HaMachpelah as Lifnei Mamre. It just tells you where it was, Maras HaMachpelah, near Mamre, now you know. But the second time it talks about it, it expands the geographical location and says in pasuk Yutes, Maras de HaMachpelah, it's the cave of Machpelah, or the field of Machpelah, Al Pnei Mamre, near Mamre, Hi Chevron, the Eretz Kena'an. I mean, that is, I think, as detailed as one could get. Surely, no one has forgotten, since the beginning of the Parsha, that we're in Hebron. And no one could possibly think that we're anywhere other than Eretz Kena'an. I mean, it's all local, it's all happening there. But why does the Pasuk emphasize these things the second time round, and not the first time round? Because the first acquisition was the property. For the property, you've got to know where it is. It's near Mamre, and that's that. But the Achuzas Kever, which is Avram establishing roots in the land of Israel, is something that has reverberations beyond the plains of Mamre and beyond Hebron to the totality of Eretz Canaan. And that's why we get the full national placement of Maras HaMachpelah, because it was the entire country that was impacted conceptually by this very first act of acquisition. And I think this perhaps will encourage us to look at the beginning of Parshas Chayesara in a new light. Most of the continuation of Chayesara is about the finding of a wife for Yitzchak, and as we know, the Pasuk talks about it at great length, and then repeats it. And that's something which Chazal comment on. Eliezer goes through the whole story again. Yofa sichosan shel abdi avos. How does the Torah show that something is beloved? By describing it at length and then repeating it. I think that perhaps this idea of showing love for something by describing in detail and then repeating, Eliezer is the second example of that phenomenon in our parsha. The first is the acquisition of Maras HaMachpelah. What's so beloved about the acquisition of Maras HaMachpelah? It's the first act of acquisition of the land of Israel. It's a beloved moment. And that's why the Torah speaks about it with such arichus. No less than what happens with Yitzhak and Rivka and Eliezer. And moreover, that is why the Torah can't stop talking about it. Whenever Maras HaMachpelah is mentioned, we go back, because it's a special time. And as surely as the Torah will repeat what happened with Rivka and Eliezer, it will repeat the acquisition wherever possible. The end of our parsha, Yaakov says it, and then once again in Vayechi, that's what's behind these repetitions, when we understand what's behind the acquisition. And with this in mind, perhaps we can address the one exceptional situation, and that is Yitzchak, where there is no elaboration, and there is no repetition, and there is no even mention of Maris HaMachpelo. Why is it something that's so pronounced with the other Avos, Avram and Yaakov, and not mentioned at all with Yitzchak? How can it be explained? I think perhaps the answer is that Yitzchak has a connection with the land of Israel that the other two didn't. Namely, he never left. He was born there, and he lived there his whole life. Avram came from Chutz Laaretz. Yaakov went to Chutz Laaretz. They were there for their time. Yitzchak is there the whole time. And therefore, if we understand that the repetition of Maris HaMachpelah is about the connection through the Avos to Eretz Yisrael, through that acquisition, maybe Yitzchak doesn't need it. The totality of his existence was embraced by Eretz Yisrael. It absolutely encompassed him. He never left there for a second. And therefore, his ongoing presence there, that's the Yitzchak connection to the land. And therefore, there's no need to elaborate in terms of the Maris HaMachpelah as it is with the other Avos. So I submit that these are ideas which can really open up the beginning of Parshas Chayesara, Psukim, which we're very familiar with, but just to illuminate them, as we say, as we always do, through the Rishonim and the Acharonim. So we've held off from Shiduchim long enough. Let's take a look at Avram and Eliezer. And that is in Perek Kaf Hei. And there are two psukim which are quite similar to each other. Let us see them. So they're Perek Kaf Dalet. So Avram first calls Eliezer and makes him take an oath. In Pasuk Gimel, Va'ashpiacha Hashem Elokei Shamayim Elokei Aretz. Right, it's a very, very serious thing. He makes him take an oath. He doesn't rely on his word. Do not take from Bnei Sekhnani by force of oath. Hashem Elokei Shamayim Elokei Haaretz. Soon thereafter, Eliezer raises the question: what if she doesn't want to come back? Can Yitzchak go there for a little bit, or maybe more than a little bit? Is that an option? And Avram says no. Pasuk Vav, Vayomer Lav Avram, Hisham Elecha Pentashiv Es Bnei Shama. No, do not take him there. Pasuk Zayin, Hashem Elokei Shamayim, Hashem, the God of Heaven, Hashem Elokochani Mibeis Avi Umeiris Benalati, who took me from my birthplace, etc. and so forth. Hu Yishlach Malach Olufanecha. He'll help you. He'll send a malach, and it will be fine. And if it's not fine, just come back. But he's not going there. So what's interesting, once again, in the precision of the phraseology. The earlier pasuk, Avram refers to Hashem as Elokei Shamayim Elokei Haaretz. But in the later pasuk, he says Hashem Elokei Shamayim. What's the change? I mean, it's the same. But why is the reference different? And Rashi, as we know, comments, Rashi says that it's before and after. In other words, when Rashi is talking in the present, when Avram is talking in the present, So thanks to him, really, Hashem is not only the God of the heavens, which people kind of knew about, or either they didn't, but it's because of Avram that Hashem is Elokei Haaretz. Hashem has spread awareness of Hashem in the world, and that's how he refers to him. In the second pasuk, when he's talking about the very beginning, when Hashem took him from his father's house, at that point, people didn't know of Hashem. He was just Elokei HaShamayim. People didn't have consciousness of him as Elokei Haaretz. And therefore, in brief, according to Rashi, when Avram is talking now, in Pasuk Gimel, now he's Elokei Shamayim Elokei Haaretz. Back then, it was only, quote-unquote, Elokei Shamayim in terms of people's awareness. But interestingly, Ramban has a completely different approach to this shift in the references to Hashem. And one could preface by saying that what for Rashi is an issue of time, for Ramban is an issue of space, of location. He prefaces it with a well-known Gemara that he discusses at length in more than one other place in his Perush, the Gemara at the end of Maseches Ksubas, which makes the very startling statement that a person who lives in Chutz La'aretz is like they don't have a god. I mean, that's the Gemara. And now that everyone's learning Daf Yomi, it's unavoidable. They'll get to it at a certain place. But what does it mean? I mean, and the Ramban explains, and of course his words themselves need to be further clarified, but the basic idea is that there is an immediacy of relationship, a directness of relationship between the Jewish people and HaKadosh Baruch Hu that only exists in Eretz Yisrael. When it's in Chutz La'aretz, it gets filtered through other things, through other entities and forces, what are referred to as sarim, as the spiritual overseas of the nations. The Jewish people don't really end up with that much by the time it's over, and that's not really such a good arrangement. It's indirect. That is how the Ramban explains that idea that a person lives in Chutz La'aretz, ki'il kemisha ein lo eloka. So, what does that have to do with our psukim? Says Ramban, because look where Avram is in Pasuk Gimel. He is in Eretz Canaan, of course. As such, he refers to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in Eretz Canaan as Elokei HaShamayim ve'Elokei HaAretz, because in Eretz Canaan, in Eretz Yisrael, you can relate to HaKadosh Baruch Hu as the God of heaven, but also the God of earth. He's right here directly. The second time round, in the second Pasuk, because he's talking about Eliezer going to Haran, and Haran is in Chutz La'aretz, says Ramban, in Chutz La'aretz Hashem is Elokei HaShamayim, not Elokei HaAretz. That's what's behind it. So as we said, what for Rashi is an issue of time stamping. At what stage was Hashem recognized as Elokei HaAretz? Before, no. Afterwards, yes. For Ramban, it's an issue of location. Here, yes. There, no. In essential terms, the relationship and the connection is not the same. And that's Ramban, classic Ramban, and it's a theme that Ramban really echoes many times throughout his Perush. What's very interesting is it could have further implications for a classic question that is raised in our Parsha. And that is, if we look in Pasuk Lamed Beis of Perik Kaf Dalet, so we've missed out the test, but Baruch Hashem, Rivka passed, and we're in Pasuk Lamed Beis. Vayavohei Shabaisa Vayifatach Hagmalim. So he came now to Lavan's house, and opened up the camels. Vayifatach undid or somehow opened up something. What did he open up? Well, Rashi quotes, and he quotes the Medrash here. Hitir zamam shelahem. He opened up their muzzle. Avram's camels were muzzled. Shayasosem es piem shelo yiru baderech bestos acherim. Because Avram would muzzle his camels so they wouldn't graze in other people's fields. It was an added measure. Not only would he not allow them to, he'd make sure they whenever they were out, they would be muzzled so they shouldn't graze in anyone else's field. That's a well-known Medrash, well-known Rashi, Avram's camels, you can see them a mile away. What can we say? They have muzzle. But Ramban again quotes a Medrash, and the whole conversation in this Medrash is simply beyond the discourse as we would normally understand it. The Medrash objects. Says the Medrash, Avram's camels don't need muzzling. How can you? It objects to this explanation. Why should he muzzle his camels? His camels don't need muzzling. Why not? On what basis do you say that? Says the Medrash, Velo yiyu gemalav shel Avram pachos michamoro shel Pinchas ben Yair. Surely Avram's camels are no less, on less of a madrega than the donkey of Pinchas ben Yair. Who's Pinchas ben Yair and who's his donkey? Well, it's a famous, the Gemara Chulin talks about it. He leased it out, his donkey, and the donkey wouldn't eat. So the renter comes back and says, your donkey's not eating, there's something wrong. To which Pinchas ben Yairah says, "Have you taken miser from your food?" Which led to an awkward moment of silence when the person admitted that he hadn't. Says Pinchas ben Yairah, "Take your trumas of miseris. I'm sure everything will be fine." And he did, and the donkey ate. Which teaches us, says the Gemara, that Hashem doesn't bring takala, not to tzaddikim, but even to their animals, because a person's property also is under their auspices, is under their aegis. Says the Medrash, "Now, do you mean to tell me that Reb Pinchas ben Yair's donkey is not going to eat from something he can't eat, and Avram's wood? Can't be. And therefore that can't be the meaning of the words, vayifatach hagmalim." And all of this is quoted by Ramban. And Ramban identifies with the Medrash's question. He doesn't think that's what it means. They don't need muzzling. They never eat from something that's ossis to them. It's Avram's camels. And this comment of Ramban, I think, is very important. It's not so well known, but it needs to be. It should be, because it sheds a lot of light on other comments of Ramban, which are much more well known, for better or for worse. Sometimes for worse. Ramban's famous criticism of Avram Avinu in the time of the famine. He went down, says Ramban, he shouldn't have gone down. Hashem will take care of him, and put Sarah in danger. Famous Ramban, Chet Godo Chota Avram Avinu Bishkoga. There was no question that that's the position of Ramban. People dispute it, but he's the Ramban. But it's the same Ramban who's talking in criticism of Avram's decisions, who objects to the notion that his camels should even need muzzling, because they would never do the wrong thing. All of this, you can't selectively have your Ramban's approach to these things. You need the whole picture to give you perspective. The very same Ramban who has these issues about Avram's camels, now go back to his discussion of Avram, Chet Godo Bishkoga. It might be a little bit more delicate than we otherwise may have thought. But in any case, this is Ramban's, it's the Medrash's challenge. Surely Avram doesn't need to muzzle his camels. Well, some Mefarshim say very simply, he doesn't need to muzzle his camels, but other people do, and if Avram doesn't, no one else will. In other words, it could very well be that he did so to set an example, let people know. He personally knows that he can trust his camels and they're not going to eat from Gezel and that's all okay. But he wishes to be a good example. He wishes to encourage other people not to steal. And most other people's camels aren't on the Madrega of Avram's camels. Without muzzles, they will graze wherever. And therefore, it could be very simply to set an example for others that he muzzled his camels, even though he didn't really need to. That's a very straightforward approach, which is taken by a number of Mefarshim. But Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky has an unbelievable suggestion. And it's based on one of the kinos in Tisha B'Av. To somewhere towards the end, I forgot to check which number, it's ascribed to Rabbi Shlomo ibn Gabirol. Although some say it's already one of Rabbi Yehuda Halevi, some of them are the authorship is disputed, so hard for us to know how to arbiter such a thing or even know what's at stake there. But in any case, it's one of those kinos which are talking in praise of Eretz Yisrael, how things used to be, how they are now, and it says like this, Bach, because these kinnas address Eretz Yisrael directly, right? Sion Haloti Shali, etc. Bach kol behema v'of chachamu. In you, says the Baal Hakina, says the author, the Paitan. In you, all animals and birds became wise. Adei kachamor haya lefanim leven yair chamorayach. To the extent that there was a donkey in your midst, like Ben Yair, that's Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair, that type of thing happened with you talking to Eretz Yisrael. Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky, and I think that this is the point where, aside from everything else, we realize that whereas most people, their focus or their attention to detail in the kinnis, in a good scenario, I don't know exactly how far it would go, but here are the greats going through the whole thing. And if you hit number 27 or 35 and there's something happens, so you take note of it. We see from here something which the Gemara never spoke about. Namely, this Madrega, which is ascribed to the donkey of Pinchas Ben Yair, which ultimately is the Madrega of Pinchas Ben Yair, It is said in praise of Eretz Yisrael. That is to say, it's a madrega that all of his possessions rose in that way because he lived in Eretz Yisrael. And the kinah bemoans the fact that we don't have that if we're not there. That's a very big chiddush. Stam, just in terms of the kinahs. What does it have to do with us? Says Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky. If we take the Medrash at his word, and we say that Avram's camel should be no less than Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair's donkey. If his donkey didn't eat that which he shouldn't, so Avram's camel shouldn't eat that which we shouldn't. But if we remind ourselves that that once again is a madrega in Eretz Yisrael, so then maybe if they're leaving and going to Choram, you might want to bring muscles with them. Because who knows if the madrega that they enjoy, Bach, Kol Chachamuch, Behema V'Of, etc., would apply in Chutz La'aretz. And therefore, when you travel with the muzzles to Chutz La'aretz. So that's an altogether fascinating discussion. And again, it focuses on these very practical explanations of the psukim, but what the underlying idea, once again, is the centrality of Eretz Yisrael, which runs through the parsha now. In other words, the opening section is all about establishing connection and roots, etc., achuza in Eretz Yisrael. And even as the pasuk goes on to talk about other things, you see that the theme that's running through is the centrality of Eretz Yisrael. Let's have a look for just a few moments at Eliezer's meeting with Rivka's family, because at a certain point that has to happen. The girl is fantastic, you have to meet the family. So what do we see here? Perek Kaf Dalet, Pasuk Kaf Tes. First out is Lavan. Ulrivkach Ushmo Lavan. So Rivka had a brother. This is just the two of them. He's Lavan. Vayarat Lavan ela isha chutza ela ayin. Lavan runs out to Eliezer. Fine. Okay. So in Pasuk Kaftes, Lavan is running to Eliezer. Pasuk Lamed. Vayihi kirosas anezem esatzmidim. When he sees the jewelry, ayide achoso. When he sees the jewelry, and when he hears Rivka saying, ukushamo es divrei Rivka achoso lemor, hearing the whole story, so he approaches Eliezer. What is the relationship between these two psukim? Pasuk Kaftes describes him running. Pasuk Lamed describes him seeing the jewelry. What is the connection between these two? What's the cause? What's the effect? How are they linked? Rashi comments in Pasuk Kaftes, the first Pasuk, on the words Vayaratz, running, says Rashi. Why is he running? If you're Lavan, you don't run, unless you have just cause. Lamaratz, Bamaratz, what's he running for? Says Rashi, you can look at the next Pasuk, you'll see. That's just cause. Next Pasuk, by Hikerosis Anezem, when he sees all the jewelry, he says, Omar, Ashir, who's there? He's a rich person, Eliezer. He doesn't even know he's a servant. Benosan Eina B'mamon. Once he saw money, he ran. That is Rashi's explanation. Now, we should note that the Pasuk has mentioned the cause after the running. I wouldn't say that we need to invoke the principle of a mukdama mu'ucha batorah, that it's the other way around, because it's more of a fact and then it's explanation. But nonetheless, the pasuk describes him running before it describes him having seen the jewelry. And for this reason, the Meshech Chochma has a perush which is absolutely out of this world. And I wonder what Lavan thinks of it. Because it could be that the Meshech Chochma chapped him. You see, if we take the psukim in order, Lavan's running. Okay, so the verb in Pasuk Kaftes, Vayarat Lavan Ela Ish. But actually, at the end of Pasuk Lamed, it says Vayavo Ela Ish. He came to him. So did he run to him, or did he come to him? Is that the same thing? It seems, says Meshech Chochma, that he started running, but he didn't run all the way. At a certain point, he slowed down and he just approached him. And the reason why is the jewelry. But the question is, and you see how it's like the opposite to Rashi. In other words, the sight of the jewelry didn't cause him to run. It actually caused him to slow down. But why? And why is he running in the first place? Says Meshech Chachma. There is a classic comment. It's in the Medrash and also in the Gemara. On the opening words of the Pasuk, Avram Zaken, Baba Yamim, Avram's older, Vashem Berechas Avram Bakol. And Hashem blessed Avram with everything. And as is so often the case, when we say, define everything, the Medrash says, okay. And the Medrash says, he had a daughter. So it's very interesting. This daughter, we have a Masorah about this daughter. She's not spoken about in the Chumash. In the end, really what that means is that somehow she didn't become part of the future of the Jewish people. So she's not mentioned in the Chumash, but the Gemara does note her. In a very complimentary way, actually, because basically the Gemara is saying, if you have a daughter, you have everything. I mean, that's Bakol. Bakol is this. Okay. So look carefully, says Meshech Chachma, because what happens in Pasuk Kavches? Vatara Tanara, right, the one before the two that we looked at. Vatara Tanara, Vatageid Levesima, she told her mother, Kadvarim Ha'ele. Kadvarim Ha'ele. And the letter kaf always has a connotation of approximately, like roughly, without necessarily details per se. What that means is, Lavan has heard a general message. And what is the message? Eliezer's here, a servant of Avram is here for Shiduchim. So Lavan knows that Avram has a daughter. And he's the older brother. And he thinks this person is here for him. So he starts running. As soon as he hears a very impressive person, something happened, Shiduchim, you've got to hear. So Lavan is like, I'm ready. Here I am. I'm more eligible than ever. He starts running. But then something happened. As he gets closer to Eliezer, he realizes it's not his day. It's not for him. The Pasuk Lamed is subsequent to the running. He sees girl's jewelry. What's that got to do with him? And he sees that his sister is wearing this jewelry. And moreover, when he hears Rivka saying, Kodiber elai ha'ish, exactly thus did he say, he hears the whole story, he realizes that it's not about him, it's about her. And his stride breaks, and he moves from a trot to a rather reluctant, he's not going to turn back, he can't change direction, but it's a somewhat more subdued stride that leaves him to Eliezer. So it's a completely different, again, based on the Gemara with regards to Avram's daughter, a different understanding of the Psukim, which is really, really outstanding. What most people discover in the long run, Lavan found out in the short run. That's really what it's about. But if we come back just for final couple of moments, because the issue of love on with money, it keeps going. And this will explain to us something else towards the end of the parak. Pasuk Nun. Pasuk Nun. So Eliezer's told his story. He's kind of at the mercy of her family. They've got to say yes. He is asking for permission. But amazingly, they say yes. And in fact, they say yes in a very encouraging way, almost in a surprising way. Vayan Lavan Ubusua Vayomu Me'ashem Yatsa Davar. This is a match made in heaven. Lo Nuchal Dabar Elecha Ra'otov. We can't add anything. I mean, the story speaks for itself. This is meant to be. We can't say anything bad. We can't even say anything good. There's nothing to add. It's certainly. We're only too happy. That's interesting. Because the next morning, they don't seem to be too happy at all. In Pasuk Nun Hei, and Eliezer stayed the night, and they get up the next morning, and he's ready to go, and all of a sudden they start stalling. And stalling seemingly with a view to perhaps even backing out. Because initially, they, in Pasuk Nun Aleph, they say, here's Rivka, go, kach v'leich, with all of our blessings. And all of a sudden, now Pasuk Nun Hey, v'yom rachia v'yima, teshev anara itanu yamim o'asor, no need to do anything hasty, let her stay here a year, 10 months, something, you know, just to kind of get herself right. That's the beginning of really, who knows where that's going to end, who's going to come back. What happened? What changed between their enthusiastic response the night before and their less than enthusiastic approach today? Says the Shem Yishmuel, the Sokotchover Rebbe, why are they so enthusiastic? And they, I mean, they sound firmer than ever. Mi Hashem Yatza Davar, it's unbelievable. Because they see how much money he has. I mean, he just turned up with these opening gifts. Right? They look at Rivka. She's got bracelets everywhere and rings and this could work out very well for us. So they're very happy about it. But then something very interesting happens in Pasuk Nun Gimel. A bit of a disappointment. Vayotzei Eved Klei Chesed Uchlei Zahav Ubegadim. Eliezer takes out even more silver vessels, more golden vessels, clothing. Vayiten leRivka, he gave it to Rivka. Rivka's the only one who's getting these things. What about everyone else, says the Pasuk? Umigdonos, and delicacies. Rashi explains, what's delicacies? Shevi imo mine peyro shel Eretz Yisrael. He brought fruit. Land of Israel. And he gave them to who? Nasan la'achiha ule'ima, to her brother and her mother. So second prize is fruit. And at this point, they realize that they're not going to get much out of the shidduch, because there's a lot of gold and silver, but it's all going to Rivka. And what's left for them? Jaffa oranges. Or maybe Dead Sea minerals recently made available. But beyond that, and at that point they begin to rethink that it's not nearly going to be as lucrative as they thought it would be, and they're having second thoughts, because if there's nothing in it for them, so then maybe it's not worth it for them. But of course Eliezer says, we'll call Rivka, and Rivka says to go. That is her own lech lecha, and maybe it's for the best that she went in spite of her family, because it's a kind of a break similar to Avram's lech lecha, because this is her lech lecha to join the Jewish people of all the imos. I mean, Sarah came with Avram, but Rivka is now detaching and attaching herself to Avram's family. And the rest, of course, is history, our history. We'll leave it over there for this evening. Sure.